All right. So today we'll talk about evaluation. Evaluation is what you do when you are trying to measure how well your system is performing. So in this class, we talked a lot about different types of machine learning tasks. So supervised learning, unsupervised learning, and in general, as you build a classifier, you may want to test how well it's doing, so that you can decide which particular classifier or which regression system you want to use, or what representation for your data you want to select to use with your classifier. So that's what evaluation is all about. So the basic questions in evaluation, you're trying to find out how well your system is doing, usually in relation to some baseline system that you have. Another issue that you're trying to address is when you're evaluating your system, you usually do it on a testing set, meaning you've gathered some data, you've set aside some part of it for testing, then you train your classifiers, you test it on a testing data. But ultimately what you're interested in is not how well your classifier is going to work on the testing data. What you want to know is how well it will generalize to the data that you haven't seen before. That's really the ultimate test. And we'll talk a little bit about how we can possibly sort of estimate the performance on unseen data. So specifically, things I'll talk about today are the training and testing splits and various ways in which we can do them. And I'll spend quite a bit of time talking about the different evaluation measures and which measures you want to use for which scenarios. The first and perhaps the main thing, hopefully by now everybody's familiar with this, but when you've built a classifier or a regression system using some data, you cannot use that same data to test how well your classifier will generalize to new data. The performance on the training data will never be representative of future performance, and so what will happen in general is if you're using more and more powerful models, they will be able to overfit fit the training data quite closely, but your performance on the testing data, sort of on the future data, will suffer. So the general thing that you do to address this is you take your data set, you split it randomly, and usually you end up generating either sort of two or three sets. So you always have the training set. That is the set that you use to estimate the parameters of the classifier. So for example, to learn the weights in logistic regression, or to construct the decision tree on, or the training set becomes the basis for the nearest neighbors algorithm. So you also typically have a validation set. So that is something that you use, that it's a data set that's, you set it aside. And once you build a decision tree, you use the validation set to set meta parameters of the algorithm. So for example, in decision trees, you know that a decision tree will always perfectly classify the data. You know, that's the training data, that's a given. So your performance on the training data will always be 100% accurate. But that's because the decision tree will always overfit to the data set until it sort of gets individual, the leaves will contain individual entries in the data. So you can use a validation set to figure out what depth of the tree is optimal for generalizing to new data. Likewise, nearest neighbor, if you're talking about nearest neighbor classifiers, one nearest neighbor will always classify your training data perfectly by definition, right? Because every point is its own nearest neighbor, so you will assign the correct class. So that's not particularly interesting. So if you're picking value k based on your training data, you will pick k equals 1 as optimal. But k equals 1 may not be optimal for generalizing. That's where you use the validation set to test how well it works. We talked about regularization in regression. So in regression, you would use a validation set to figure out the balance between the misclassification rate and the penalty that, that you introduce for the size of the weight vector. Right? So if you tried to do that on the training set, there would be no penalty for the weight vector, it would pick the zero penalty. But if you try to do it in a validation set, then it will select a reasonable value of the parameter. So that's what you use validation set for. And then testing set, that is something that ideally, if you have lots of data, that is something that you sort of leave aside and you never ever touch it until you are confident that that your system is performing as best as it could, and then you take your testing set and then you run your classifier or regressor on that testing set, that set that you've never touched, you've never done anything with it, and then you report performance on that testing data. So that's what you would like to, that's what you want to do ideally if you have enough data, right? So testing data, you don't do anything with it, you touch it once, you just run your system once on it and report. All right. Now, so suppose you've taken a data set, you've trained a classifier, and you've done everything correctly, you've done the validation, and now you take your testing set, and that testing set maybe has 100 items. So you run them through your classifier, and you measure how well your classifier works, and perhaps your classifier is 75% correct, or 25% error rate. So what you may want to ask is, so this is the error on the testing data. What can I expect as far as the error on future data, the data that I haven't seen before? And of course, you cannot compute that because you haven't seen future data. So you cannot answer that question definitively, but you can take a guess. And the way you take a guess is you say, well, I'm going to assume that the testing data I have is representative of all the data that's out there. So my testing data is a sample, a random sample of all the data that my classifier could ever face. Okay, so it's an assumption, but you have to make some sort of an assumption, and it's often a reasonable assumption. So if your data doesn't change with time tremendously, then you can assume that the testing set that you have is going to be representative of things to come. So so what do you do then? Basically, what you're assuming is there is this population of data out there. I have randomly sampled a subset of 100 elements. I have run my classifier on it, and I get 25%. Now, what I want to do is I want to sort of figure out what is the ballpark of where the true error on this entire set could be, right? On the set that I don't see. And you can get a ballpark estimate through the following method. So we've assumed that the 100 elements is a random subset of this population. So if you assume that the true error of the classifier is E, so let's just say that this E is the true error, whatever it is, then what does that mean? That means that for any given instance, any future instance that I'm going to see, the probability of misclassifying that instance is E, right? Now, if I take a random subset of this entire universe of unseen data, a subset of 100 elements, what is going to be my expected error rate on that subset? So the number of errors, or the proportion of errors in the subset, the expected value is just going to be E, right? So, because that's the true error rate. Every instance is misclassified with, say, E percent chance. So if I have 100 elements, I expect E of them to be misclassified. So that's the mean. But you can also characterize the variance, right? So if you're assuming that the classification of each item is independent, so the items are independent of each other, which is often the case, then the variance of misclassification is going to be just the binomial, right? So you're going to have E, 1 minus E over N as the variance of misclassification within a subset of N examples, right? So N is 100 here, okay? And what you also know is, in addition to that, as N gets larger and larger, the distribution of errors over these subsets will start to approach a normal distribution. So it's going to be a normal distribution with this mean and this variance. And now you can use that to try to estimate a confidence interval for the true error metric. Why? Because this 25% error rate that you got on your testing set, that is one sample from the overall population. So the inference problem that you're looking at is, given this huge population, I know that its mean is E, the variance is E1 minus E over N. Now I sampled once, one set of 100 items, and I got 25%. So what is E? Where does E lie? Okay. And to do that, what you're basically doing is you're saying it's normally distributed, so this is the mean, this is the unknown mean, and what I'm looking for is I'm looking for the area under this Gaussian that captures 95% of the probability mass if I want a 95% confidence interval. Right? So if I want to be 95% confident that the true error is within this region, then I'm looking for a 95% area around the mean. So how do you do that? Well, it's quite simple. So the expected value of the error is going to be, it's going to be just your measured error, so 25%, and then you're going to look at as many standard deviations to the left and to the right as you need to get 95 or 90% of the area. So that's the basic rule. So this is your mean. This is going to be your standard deviation. Oh, sorry, there should be a square root of that thing. Okay. And in order to compute how many standard deviations you need to get, you take the inverse of the Gaussian cumulative distribution. So if you're using a numerical package, then you just take the inverse error function over that. So I have some examples here for computing the confidence intervals for this 25%. The thing that I've just realized is that the numbers here are wrong, so I'm not going to go through them. I'm going to update the slides and put up the correct numbers. So the equation is correct, but the numbers are wrong. All right. So you can that's the procedure that you use to estimate the performance on future data, how well your classifier is going to do. And what you get is you get a confidence interval. So you can say that I don't know exactly how well it performed, but with 90% confidence or with 95% confidence, I can say that it's going to be, say, between 20 and 30% error rate. That's what you get. All right. When you're doing the splitting of the data, when you're taking your data set and splitting it into the training and testing portions, you have conflicting priorities. On one side, you want to make your training set as large as possible because that's going to mean that you are producing the best classifier that you can or the best regressor that you can. On the other hand, you want to leave the testing set size as large as possible because the larger the testing set size, the more confident you are that you are measuring the performance correctly. Right? And of course, you cannot have training and testing overlapping because that completely invalidates the whole idea of splitting them in two. So one way to get the best of both, one way to have as much data as you want for training the classifier and also as much data as you can have for testing it, is to use cross-validation. The basic idea of the cross-validation is, suppose you're doing a two-fold cross-validation, you take your set, you split it into the training set and the testing set. First you do the normal thing, you train the classifier on training set and test it on the testing set, and then you reverse the roles. So you train the classifier on the testing set and then see how well it does on the training set. This way you're using all of the items in your data set as testing instances. So in fact, your estimate of the error, of the misclassification error, is going to be as accurate as you can possibly get with the amount of data that you have. So that would be two-fold cross-validation. In practice, the standard is to do tenfold. The idea there is it differs from domain to domain what exactly you do, but this is a common thing, at least in machine learning. You split the data into 10 sections, and then you do something like the following. So if I have sets S1 through S10, I'm going to take the first 9, S1 through S9, train the classifier on that, and test on the remaining 10%, test on the S10. And then I'm going to take everything except S9, train a classifier on that, and test on S9. And then I'm going to repeat that 10 times. So each time, I'm using 90% of the data to train a classifier, and the remaining 10% to test it. The critical thing is all of the test sets are disjoint. So they're completely separate from each other. And by the time I'm finished with the procedure, I have used every instance in my data as a testing point once. And it's a it's an appropriate setup because you never train on the testing data, and at the same time, after the 10 iterations, you've used everything that you can as your testing instances. So your estimates are hopefully as good as possible. And then what you do is you measure performance on each one of the folds, S10, S9, S8, and then you average the results and you report that as your performance. Okay, so an extreme example of cross-validation is leave one out procedure. What you do there is it's effectively n-fold cross-validation where n is the number of instances, right? So if you have a million instances in your data set, you take one instance, leave it as a testing set, and use the other 999,999 as training. You build your classifier based on that and test on one instance, right? And then you take the next instance and you repeat the procedure. Okay, so the attraction of doing that is, so in the previous case, when you're doing tenfold cross-validation, you can use at most 90% of your data for training, right? So here, you are in fact using almost 100%, n-1 instances for training. So your classifier is, you know, you cannot say that, well, my classifier just didn't get enough data for training. Yes, it did. It got all of the data for training. And also, after you repeat this n times, you will have tested on every instance as well. So it seems like an attractive idea. There's a number of gotchas that you have to be aware of if you want to use leave one out. So first of all, the computational cost of this is extremely high unless you have a method that allows you to subtract and add training instances incrementally at a very small cost. This is going to be very expensive to do, right? So, for example, out of the box, if you tried an SVM, you just can't update it in a very simple manner. You would have to relearn it. So, and that's very expensive if you have a large data set. So computational cost is high, but there are some tricks. If you were doing nearest neighbors, it wouldn't be an issue, right? Because nearest neighbors adding and subtracting a training instance is trivial. It doesn't cost you anything. So, but it does lead to also sort of interesting contradictions. So, in addition to the computational cost, there are also some peculiar things that can happen with leave one out. So, one example. So, I mentioned that it's not a problem for k nearest neighbor, but If you use k-nearest neighbors and your data just happened to have duplicates in it, right? So instances were occasionally duplicated, right? Normally it would not be much of a problem, and with tenfold cross-validation it might not be too much of a problem. But if you use leave one out, then you will always have 100% accuracy on this data, right? Because every item has a duplicate. You take an item, you move it out of the set, and if you're using one nearest neighbor, there's always a training instance that's identical to this testing instance, right? So that's a bit of a problem. Now that's a bit contrived, but the second example is a little more realistic. So suppose you have completely random data, which means that somebody replaced whatever attributes you had with random numbers, right? So now your representation X doesn't tell you anything about your class, right? For the sake of argument, suppose that the classes are equally probable, so there is half positive and half negatives in your data. Now, since the attributes are random, that means your classifier cannot do any better than the prior for this data, because the data doesn't allow your classifier to make a decision that's any more intelligent, because it's random. So your best performance on this task should be 50%, right? You just randomly decide if it's a positive class or if it's a negative class. But if you use leave one out, then in fact your error rate is not going to be 50%, it's going to be 100%, right? And why is that? Because if you take, so imagine you had, I had 1,000 items in my data. Data is completely random, 500 positives, 500 negatives. Now I take one item, let's say it was positive, I move it to the testing set, I do whatever magic I do on the training data, and on the training data, because the data is random, my classifier, the best classifier possible, will just use the prior, and the prior is 500 over 499, right? So the classifier will always say, it's just so slightly more likely to be negative than positive. So the classifier will probably say negative, and of course you have subtracted a positive item. Again, sort of a contrived example, but it's just, it goes to say that if you do leave one out, you will have strange you will sometimes have strange and interesting things happen in your data. All right, a slightly more general problem related to this this problem. So the last example that I did with leave one out, it's basically when you're separating the training data from the testing data, by doing that you end up affecting the distribution of classes in the data, right? It's not just limited to leave one out. It happens with k-fold cross-validation as well. So sometimes when you split your data, especially if some of the classes are underrepresented, if some of the classes are very rare, it's very easy to split in such a way that one of your folds, one of your 10 subsets, doesn't have any instances classified with this rare class, right? It's quite easy to end up with a situation like that. And even if it does, the distribution of rare classes over these 10 subsets could be very uneven, and that will affect the performance of your classifier quite heavily. So, just imagine if one of the classes is 1% of the data, you did a tenfold cross-validation, and maybe you got 90% of that rare class in one of the folds, and then almost nothing in the rest of the data. Right? So that will not be able to classify this rare class properly. So the way to deal with that is called stratification. The idea of stratification is, as you split your data, you don't do it randomly. You do it in such a way as to preserve the balance of classes in the data. So, and a simple way to do that is to split items starting with classes. So the idea there would be you take each class in turn, and you split all the items in that class into 10 folds, and then you split the other classes and randomly assign them to the 10 folds. Okay. So what that will do is that will do a random split, but it will also preserve a balance of classes over the folds, which is what you want. All right. So now suppose you've split your data, you've done the stratification, maybe you're doing 10-fold cross-validation, and now you measured, you're comparing two systems, right? You've got classifier A, perhaps decision trees, and classifier B, SVMs. So you have k-folds, you have k-subsets. For each one of those, you have measured the accuracy of your system, and you have two numbers. So EA1, that's the error of system A on the first set, and EB1 is the error of system B on the same data set. So if you average these numbers together, so perhaps you'll end up with some average aggregate errors, and maybe on average, the error of system A is smaller than the error of system B. So one question that you may want to ask is, does that actually mean that A is better than B, right? So the error of A seems to be smaller than the error of B, but you may want to consider how the individual errors over the folds are distributed. So we talked about confidence intervals and distribution of errors. So that's the same thing that you may want to consider here. So for example, if this is the error of A and this is the error of B, it looks like there is a bit of a difference between them, but if you plot the confidence intervals and they overlap like that, then perhaps A is not really different than B, and any differences between them are due to chance. So that's what you want to figure out. If the difference between A and B is accidental, if it could happen by chance, or if the difference really reflects the fact that A is significantly better than B. And the way to answer that question is with a statistical significance test. So what the significance, and there's a number of tests that you can use, and if you're dealing with accuracies, the appropriate test is the t-test. And in this case, specifically, what you would do, because you have, you are using the same splits of the data, so what you can do is you can compare performance of A to performance on B on the same split directly. So what you can do is you can take the difference, the absolute difference between the errors of system A and system B on data split I, let that difference be di, and then if you take the mean of the di's divided by the standard deviation, that actually has a student's distribution, and you can use a t table to look up the significance, whether that difference is significant or not. So it's I'm not giving a formula to compute it because you wouldn't. You would either use a statistical package, or you would look it up in a stats book if you happen to be old-fashioned. So this only works if the differences are independent, and that can be ensured as long as you have no overlap in the splits. So if you're doing cross-validation properly, if the first split is completely separate from the second, from the third, and so on, then you can apply this test. So it works for accuracies. Sort of a caveat: you cannot in the following slides, I'm going to talk about some other measures that you can use to figure out performance, things that are different from accuracy, for example, things like precision. You would not be able to use the same test with precision because the numbers won't actually follow the right distribution. All right, so now I'll talk about evaluation measures. So evaluation measures, these are basically, the way to think about them is these are your alternatives, or these are different ways to define accuracy. And the reason that you have different measures is because you have different scenarios, and I'll give examples where accuracy just doesn't work as an evaluation measure. So I'll talk about three different families. So I'll talk about the measures that we can use for classification, regression, and also for unsupervised learning. So for classification, the basic idea is we have a set of classes, and the error is when you predict the wrong class. So all of our classification evaluation measures will in some way count how many times did I get the wrong class when I was predicting. For regression, we're predicting real numbers. So instead of counting how many times I was wrong, I will try to measure how wrong I was. So I predicted a real number, how far away is it in terms of sort of real numeric distances, how far away is it from what I was supposed to predict. And unsupervised evaluation there is actually really quite hard. So what you try to do is you try to capture to what degree your system was able to describe the data. And that's very vague, and I'll try to give some examples of the things you could use, but it's just really hard. Okay, so the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to describe, I'm going to build all the classification measures, at least all the classification evaluation measures out of the following building blocks. So suppose that this is the set of all testing instances that you're dealing with. Now, you are running a classifier, and perhaps it's a multi-class classifier. So for a given class C, so C may be spam, these are the items that your system thinks belong to class C. So these are the predictions. This is what the system predicts is C. This is the set of items that are really class C, right? And it's, and the sets are different because your system will make some mistakes. There's going to be some overlap, and that overlap is we're going to call it the set of true positives. So those are the items that were really in class C, and your system correctly predicted that they were in class C. The false positives are the ones that really were not in class C, but your system thought they were in class C. The false negatives are the ones that really were in class C, but your system didn't get them. So, by the way, the false positive and false negative, it's always confusing at first. What you want to think about, the negative and the positive, that refers to what your system predicts. And the false or true refers to the true labels, right? So these are false negatives because my system predicted them as negative and it was wrong. These are false positives because my system predicted that they were positive, that they were in class C, it was wrong. They weren't. Okay. True negatives, those are the ones where my system thinks they're not in the class and they really aren't in the class. So these are the building blocks, and we're going to build all the classification measures out of them. You can do them as a Venn diagram. You can also lay them out as a confusion table, and hopefully you have seen one of these in Weka output, right? So typically what you have is you have either rows or columns corresponding to whether the item is really in class C or not, and then perhaps you have columns that correspond to which class was predicted. So if the system predicted class C, then you're in this column, otherwise you're in that column. And again, if they agree, then you have true positives and true negatives, and if they disagree, you have false positives and false negatives. So hopefully that's clear. So it's quite easy to generalize these confusion tables to multiple classes. So here I'm just showing class C or not class C, yes or no. If you have five classes, you would have five rows and five columns, right? And then you see which classes were misclassified as which classes. And whenever you look at one of these, what you want is a good system will have most of the entries on the diagonal. So the true positives, true negatives, or if you have more than two, anything on the diagonal, those are the ones that your system got correctly. So you want those to be as large as possible. And everything off the diagonal, you want it to be as small as possible. All right. So. Now let's go back to what we've been talking about until now. So the classification error, we've been talking about errors. What is classification in terms of this building blocks? It's very simple. So it's the total number of mistakenly classified items divided by the total number of items, which is your the number of false positives plus false negatives divided by everything. And everything is just true positives plus true negatives plus false positives plus false negatives. Okay. Your accuracy, which sometimes we talk about accuracy instead, is 1 minus the error. So that's just true positives plus true negatives divided by everything. So classification error and accuracy, they're good measures. It's important to realize that for some domains, they really don't tell you anything useful. So for example, think about predicting okay, so here's an example that I like. Say you're building a search engine and user types in the query and you're trying to classify for every web page whether or not it's going to be relevant to the user or not, whether you should show it to the user or not. If you're using accuracy as a measure of performance, then it's very easy to build a system that's virtually 100% accurate, right? And the way you could, so can anyone tell me how you would do that?
Just say that everything is irrelevant.
That's right, say that everything is irrelevant, right? So why would that happen? Why would it work that way? So look at the equation for accuracy. The accuracy is two positives plus two negatives, right? So if you think about search results, the number of really positive examples, the number of documents that really are relevant to the query is, you know, maybe 100, maybe 1,000, and the web is perhaps 100 billion pages. So your true positives can be at most 1,000, right? And your true negatives are 100 billion. So if you say no to everything, you have maximized your true negatives, and it doesn't actually matter what else is in the mix, right? So you're going to have 100 billion minus 100 divided by 100 billion, and that's 100% accurate. Okay, so and this is not the only example. So you can imagine any time you're predicting rare events, accuracy or classification error is just a bad measure to use. It doesn't tell you anything useful about your data. So you want something else. And the solution there is, depending on your domain, so in the web search example, you use slightly different metrics, recall precision, which I'm going to talk about next. So if you're just predicting rare events, which is sort of not quite as biased, if you have a domain where you can sort of attach utilities or costs to the misclassifications, then you sometimes use sort of a weighted combination of the different type of errors. So here's an example: if you're predicting whether an earthquake is going to happen, you know, the best strategy, accuracy-wise, is to always say no, there's not going to be an earthquake, right? This way you're going to be as accurate as anything else, because earthquakes don't happen very often. Assuming in the parts of the world where people normally live. So if you measure accuracy, then your optimal strategy is to always say no. But if you assign different costs to false positive and false negative classifications, then you get a slightly different error. So if you make a false positive on an earthquake, what that means is you've gotten a lot of people worried. And that's obviously costly, but it's not nearly as costly as telling them everything is okay and then there's an earthquake, right? So that's a lot more costly. And if you put different costs on the false positives and the false negatives, then you can come up with a good trade-off. So what are the other errors that you can use for these domains? So in addition to just the raw false positives and false negatives, we often use false positive rates and false negative rates. So this is the number of false positives I committed out of all the false positives that I could have gotten, right? And all the false positives that I could have gotten, that is just the number of negatives. So that's true negatives plus the false positives. So that's the gray plus this yellow bit, okay? So that's your false positive rate. It's also called a false alarm rate. So that tells you what percentage of negatives did you misclassify as positive. A false negative rate, also called a miss rate, is the number of false negatives divided by the total number of positives. So what percentage of positives you misclassified as negatives. Recall is a measure that's often used in language-related fields, and actually in quite a few different areas. It's also called the true positive rate, and that's just 1 minus the miss rate. So that's the probability of positives that you got, the percentage of positives that you got correctly. Precision is an interesting metric that's used in any time you have a user looking at results. It's slightly different from the true positive rate. What precision does is it looks at the amount of true positives out of the things that you declared positive, right? So it's a user-oriented metric because presumably you're taking this set, everything that was predicted to be positive, and then you're presenting it to somebody, to a user perhaps, to look at. And what you're measuring is basically how much junk you gave the user to look at. It's important to realize that you cannot report just one of these, right? These always have to be reported in pairs. If you don't do that, it's very easy to optimize. It's very easy to optimize one of these to be 100% or zero, whatever you want it to be. So, for example, if I wanted a zero false alarm rate, how do I do that? Classify everything as negative. So if I never say anything is positive, then I'm never going to make a false alarm. Easy, right? If I wanted a 100% recall, how would I do that? Classify everything as positive, right? So give everything to the user, and then you have gotten all the positive things, and you just don't care about the precision. Right? So you always have to report these in pairs. Sometimes reporting them in pairs is not convenient. Sometimes you want a single number, so that's perhaps you're tuning an algorithm trying to find optimal parameters. So you want to somehow combine the measures. There's a number of ways of combining them. So the simplest one is cost, where you essentially assign a cost, numeric or monetary or whatever, to the false positives that you make and to the false negatives that you make, and then you add up, sort of you multiply the number of false positives by the cost, false negatives by the cost, add them together, and that gives you some sort of a metric that you can tune. And then the question of designing the right evaluation metric is the question of coming up with the right costs for the two classes. So in some fields, there are specific metrics that you can use. So for example, in text-related fields, one popular measure is F1. And that's a combination of recall and precision. It's a slightly unusual combination. It's a harmonic mean. So what that is designed to do is that is designed to sort of penalize systems that have very poor recall or very poor precision. This is a measure that wants balanced performance against both recall and precision. And then, of course, in some domains, you have very specific measures which aren't necessarily tied to false positives and false negatives. But you can certainly use that to evaluate the utility of your system. All right, so that's just a recap of what we just did. So I talked about reporting these numbers in pairs. It's important to realize that just reporting them in pairs doesn't always help you pick the right one. So if I have two systems over there, and if one system has a true positive rate of 50% and a false positive rate of 20%, and another system has a sort of recall of 100% and false alarm rate of 60%, how do you decide if one is better than another? So the recall is higher for the second one, but the false alarm rate is also higher, and you want low false alarm. So which one is better? Yeah, it depends on the domain. But there is a bigger problem with this. And the bigger problem is this is actually an ill-formed question. So if somebody asks you that question, that's a bad question to ask. You should not even try to answer that. It's malformed. The thing is, these performance metrics, they could actually reflect the same identical system, just run at different thresholds, at different confidence levels. So if somebody gives you two pairs of numbers and says that, you know, this one is better than another one, no. You cannot make that claim. So let me sort of illustrate this. So suppose I'm doing spam classification, and I have some, and my system produces some form of a confidence, right? So what is a confidence? If you think back to logistic, right? Logistic spits out a number between 0 and 1. Usually you say if the number is bigger than 0.5, then it's positive. If it's smaller than 0.5, than its negative class. But the number itself means something, right? So things that are closer to 1, further away from 0.5, the system is more confident that it's a positive. And things that are closest to 0, the system is more confident that they're negative. So suppose that this axis represents this confidence. And what I'm putting there is I'm putting there different emails. And the green ones are spam, and the gray ones are ham. And I'm trying to predict whether they're spam or ham. So if I place my threshold somewhere in here, and I'm not saying what this is. So somewhere in here you have a 0, and then somewhere in here you have a 1. And if I place this threshold here, somewhere between 0 and 1, things that are higher than that are going to be classified as spam. Things that are lower are going to be classified as ham. And what do I get? I get the true positive rate of 4 over 8, because I got 1, 2, 3, 4 out of 8 total spam emails. And I've got 1, 2, 3 out of 15 ham emails. So if I place my threshold here, I have a true positive rate of 50% and a false positive rate of 3 over 15, which should work out to be 20%. Right. So that's if I place my threshold here. If I happen to place my threshold at a different point, I will get a different true positive rate and a false positive rate, right? And it's meaningless to ask which one is better, right? They're not two different systems. They're the same system. You just happen to pick the cutoff differently. So it's a big idea. Your threshold doesn't have to be at 0.5. You can set a threshold at 0.7 and then take everything over 0.7 as spam, right?
No one
is telling you that you can do that, that you cannot do that. All right. So if once I fix a threshold, the spam emails that score above that threshold, those are your true positives, right? And the ham emails that are above the threshold, those are your false positives. And of course, the green ones to the left of the threshold, those are your false negatives, and the gray ones to the left are your true negatives, because they should be negative. So the key idea to take out of this is if your system produces confidences, and many of the algorithms that we talked about, they do produce confidences, then you don't have to evaluate at a fixed threshold. You can try out different thresholds, and at different thresholds, you will get different errors. You will get different true positive rates, different false positive rates. And sometimes the best thing you can do, the best way to get a complete picture of how your algorithm performs, is to plot true positive rates against false positive rates as you slide the threshold from left to right, right? So you can imagine, I can imagine starting here. If I start here, if I place my threshold at 1 for logistic, then what is my false positive rate is going to be? It's going to be 0, right? Because nothing will